Hi, this is Gideon Rothstein with the responsible day for the 19th of Tishrei, which is the fourth day of Chol HaMoed in Eretz Yisrael and the third day of Chol HaMoed outside of Eretz Yisrael. And today we're going to study a response by Tshuveh Mishneh Halachot by Menashe Klein on writing Chiddushei Torah on Chol HaMoed. So not only is this response dated to the 19th of Tishrei, but actually I apologize, that's not true. I think I'm looking at the Tshuveh now, it's not dated the 19th of Tishrei, it's that I had a hard time finding Tshuvot written on Chol HaMoed Sukkot, so I am on Chol HaMoed Pesach as it was, so I'm sort of reaching a little bit, and here it's a tshuva related to the issue of writing Divrei Torah on Chol HaMoed. So he, Moshe Klein, this is from Mishneh Halachot, Gimel Ayin Vav, Volume 3, Responsible Number 76. I want to thank the OU, Rabbi Jacob Bromwitz, and David Hachhauser for helping us put the shirim online. And now to the matter itself, which is that the man writing to Menashe Klein had said, that Menashe Klein had written B'tarich Ech Aleph to Chol HaMoed Pesach B'tshuva Nun Gimel. In earlier tshuva, he had written the date was the first day of Chol HaMoed Pesach. And so this man writing him said, you can't write on Chol HaMoed. So he quoted a tshuva of the Rosh. So let's look at that tshuva of the Rosh. This is a very brief tshuva, but I'm going to give you the background sources, which will help us fill out our time and enlighten us about these issues. So the Shit HaRosh is in. Now, when the Rosh put together his Shit, I'm not sure why he does. I'm not sure how people choose it. He has it as Klal Dalid Simon Yud, the fourth general grouping, and then the tenth responsive in that grouping. And the Rosh writes, Bishnat Chameshet Alafim Shivim Vishalosh. The Rosh is living a long time ago, right? The turn of the millennium in Jewish dating is in the year 1240. 1240 started the sixth millennium of our calendar. So he's writing this tshuva in 1312 to 1313. So B'Shnat Chameshet Alafim, it's the year 5000 to today. We call the year, let's say, Tufshin Ayin Zion. But what we really mean is, hey, Tufshin Ayin Zion, Chameshet Alafim, and then Tufshin Ayin Zion. So he's living in when it's Chameshet Alfim and just numbers, right? And just 73. That's how close he was to the turn of that millennium. So that year, there was no rain. There was very sparse rain all winter. So they called for a fast day, as Jews do when you have times of trouble. That's mitzvah in the Torah to call for a fast day. The fast day part is Derabbanan, but to call for a day to call out to Hashem and beg Hashem for help with the time of trouble, that's a mitzvah in the Torah. So they did that, and they not yet had the rain. So in the first night of Pesach, after Mariv, the Rosh said, right now it's a good time to raise an issue that's always bothered me. The issue that's always bothered me is that why don't we mention rain when we need to all the way till Shavuos? Meaning our custom is, and their custom back then also, was that Kayim Pesach, you'd say Tfilat Tal, and that would be the last time you'd mention rain, and then you'd only mention Tal for the summer and not rain. And the theory is that rain in that time isn't good for you because the crops are already in the fields and it's going to ruin them and hurt them. So the Rosh says that logic doesn't work for Pesach. It works really only at Shavuos, because Shavuos, when you really have the harvest is done and then you have things. But until then, maybe rain is okay. So people answered him, or some of the people standing there said, good idea. And they were having a problem with the rain. So they sent the Chazan back up. And they told the Chazan, you know what? Tomorrow, don't do Tfilat Tal. Just keep mentioning Mashiv Ruach HaMoed Geshem. And we'll keep saying, when it's not a holiday, V'tein Tal L'matal L'Vracha, because we still need the rain. And it's not a klala. It's not a sign of curse of any sort to have rain all the way through till Shavuot. So they do that. And they mention the Yud Gimel Midos in the course of asking for rain. They're like, they make the whole prayers. And as they're mentioning rain, everybody's, there's this whole big hubbub, right? You shouldn't think that you get to be the Rosh's stature as a Torah scholar for the generations that people don't bother you when you make decisions. He says this is what should happen. They sent to the Chazan to have this happen. Some of the people there, some of the Chachamim are there, and who hadn't been consulted, so that shows you sort of what level the Rosh thought of them as Chachamim. But they decided to say, that's not right. You can't do it. It's a Simon Klal. It's a sign of curse to have rain, to ask for rain after Pesach, which is a little odd because they hadn't had enough rain, so it wouldn't have been a curse for them. But that's what these other people claim. So the Rosh doesn't say anything until Chol HaMoed. Then Chol HaMoed, now, once it's Chol HaMoed, he writes a responsum to support his ideas. And he says, I've already knew this back when I lived in Ashkenaz. Let's remember, the Rosh was born in Germany and lived in Germany for much of his life. And he grew up in Germany. He's a Talmud, a student of the Maharam Rutenberg. So he's got good, solid German roots to his Torah. And then when he gets kicked out of Germany, he moves to Spain and becomes the greatest Torah scholar in Spain. And that's where he writes much of his material. And then his son, the Tour, writes it in Spain, in Toledo. So they're living in Spain now. He says, you should know, back when I was in Ashkenaz, it's not like I'm coming here to Sfarad, to Spain, and making up new ideas. Back when I was Ashkenaz, I had already said that those things that depend on momentary needs, those halachot that are intricately tied to needs that change with the year, with the time, with the season, so there's no such thing as when you change them that you're violating the Torah. Because the Torah never, in those situations, made an ironclad rule. So something like this, like rain, he says, in those kinds of situations, you have to follow that year's needs and that place's needs and that place's times. So for example, when the Gemara says, after Pesach, rain is a bad sign, that's Bavel. They wrote it in Bavel in Babylonia. Shochenet al Mayim Rabim. They had a lot of natural water around them. They had lakes and rivers and things like that. Below Ayutzuchim Gshamim ad Shishim Lektkufa. So they did in the fall, didn't need rain until 60 days. After, that's where we get the custom today to not mention rain outside of Israel until December 4th or December 5th. There's a whole discussion about that, but whether that's really the right date. But forgetting that date issue, the Rosh was saying that whole idea that we wait that long. In Israel, they start 2 weeks after Sukkot, right? Because the tradition was you gave enough time for the people who would come to Yerushalayim for the Chag, for the Regel, for the holiday, to get back home. And the assumption was they wouldn't come from farther than 2 weeks' journey away. But after that, you ask for rain. Outside of Israel, it's because Bavel, the Rosh is saying that because Bavel, they didn't need rain so much. They had a lot of natural water they could irrigate in those ways. And therefore, they didn't rain so much, so they waited. Or maybe they had a later planting season, so they didn't need the rain. But in Germany, right, he's not in Germany now. He's just saying back in Germany, where you start planting things in the middle of Tishrei, everybody knows that if you don't get rain, then the planting won't go well. You need you plant then, that's the season, and you need the rain then. Right? And if you don't get the rain, so what happens is birds come and they eat it, or mice or rats come and they eat it, so you don't have a good planting. So he says, back in Ashkenaz, he used to say to himself, why are we waiting till December 4th, December 5th, to pray for rain, to say v'tein talamata levracha, to say tefillat geshem? Let's just do like the Jews of Israel. So there's more of the shiva that I'm not going to give. That's not our topic. Our topic is the Chol HaMoed issue. I just included that much here to point out that at least the Rosh, and we don't always pass like one important Torah scholar, the fact that the Rosh is a hugely important Torah scholar doesn't mean that this is the way we should paskin. But it's a perspective that I'm not sure we always recognize that somebody like the Rosh would have had, that the whole idea of when do you ask for Geshem is no ironclad halacha. That's what he's saying. He's saying there's no law of when you ask for rain. It's you ask for rain because you need rain from Hashem. So when you need rain from Hashem, depends where you live. Different places need rain from Hashem at different times for different reasons. That will guide the way we shape our tefillot. Today we don't do it that way at all, but I think it's a very important, strong point. For our purposes, it's the next line of the responsible that's important. He says, "V'lo ha'iti kotev b'chol ha'moed." I wouldn't have written on Chol HaMoed, ki lo hurgalti b'kach, because that's not my practice. Ela shetzorech sha'ahum nechilul shem shamayim. But it's a necessity because of the defamation or the sacrileging of Hashem's name. In other words, other people are saying that I did the wrong thing and that I violated the Torah in public, so I want people to understand that that's not true. And it's also a little bit necessary for right now, because right now is when we'll still be asking for Geshem. So that's the way the Rosh writes the tshuva. So the man who's writing to the Rav Menashe Klein, to the Baal HaMishneh Halachot, says, it seems like from the Rosh that you don't write on Chol HaMoed. You only write on Chol HaMoed, you have an extraordinary emergency situation, and then the man writing says, and I've never seen any of my Rebbeim who wrote on Chol HaMoed. Not only that, we have a tradition of the Halav Lor, Eino Halav Yisrael Kumosu Chol HaMoed. People who are scribes don't use their kumos, their pens on Chol HaMoed. So that was the question. Menashe Klein, for the answer, says, first off, I think it's odd that you got that inference from the Rosh. To me, and this is Gideon Rothstein speaking. You don't like when Gideon Rothstein speaks up his own opinions, please feel free to email me, girothst@gmail.com. But to me, it's one of the questions of halacha to grapple with, that people look at the same source and they come to diametrically opposed conclusions, that's, I think, a big challenge to think about. I'm not saying what it. I think other people would hear me say that and say, oh, he means that you can't ever know what the truth is. I don't mean that. I just mean that it's something to notice and be aware of. I look at a Rosh and I see it this way. The Rosh says, I would never have written this, but it was a shot at the clock. It was a time of pressure, and I had to avoid a Chilul Hashem, and that's why I'm writing it. What conclusion did I draw? The man writing the Mishnah Lachot says, conclusion is, you don't write a Chol HaMoed. Yes, it's true. It's not absolutely usur. Because whereas on Shabbos, a Shadat Chak would not allow you to write that, although it does allow you to write certain things or violate whatever. There are exceptions to that too. But even at a lower level, because it's, quote, only, unquote, Chol HaMoed, you could write, but you're not supposed to. That's the conclusion that the man writing the Menashe Klein said. Menashe Klein writes back, I don't understand what you're talking about. I think that the Rosh doesn't write, it's usur, and I'm just doing it because of Shadat Chak. He says, lo hur galti. He says, it's not my practice. And the Menashe Klein says, to me, that means that it's not that it's prohibited. It's that he had a chumrah. He wanted to treat Chol HaMoed. It's so special that he, as a chumrah, wouldn't write on Chol HaMoed. Same Rosh, same words, right? Sometimes you have a debate about the words are, what the words mean, how the words are written, but here it's the same exact thing, it's just the implications. And that's always a question, halacha, how do you know which implications draw from where? Besides which, there are plenty of other achronim, says Rav Menashe Klein, who knew this Rosh, and they write chidushim on Chol HaMoed, and then, bifrat bederot halalu, especially in our times, when we forget stuff, right? V'amonotin ha-shikha kolkach shechicha. Which is a nice play on words, right? Shikha and shikha is the Aramaic word for common. V'imlo yursham hayom. If you don't write it today, who knows what will happen to the Torah scholar, and he might not write it down. And then we'll get to Mishnah Berurah in a second for why you should write it down anyway, even if you're sure you wouldn't forget it. But let's just remember, when he says shikha, that forgetting is commonplace, that bears perhaps a moment to notice that and to remember that memory has changed over time. I remember when I was a graduate student being shocked to find this. It's true not only in the Jewish world, it's true in the non-Jewish world. There's some very excellent, if you like reading history, there's some very excellent books about how memory worked in the Middle Ages when all books were available only if somebody would copy them over. You didn't have printing presses. So books were very, very rare. Not, I don't mean rare like you couldn't find them, but if a book came your way, if you could either copy it over, so to have a copy, or you could memorize it. And people developed much stronger memories back then. Whereas nowadays, we outsource our memories. It's gotten even more so, right? It used to be when I was growing up, I knew tons of phone numbers by heart. And now, they're in my phone, so I don't bother. So it used to be that I wouldn't want to write them down in an address book because that was a pain, so I'd have to look them up and this and that. So I'd memorize them. But once I didn't have to, then I stopped doing it, and then I used that memory for other things. So when he says a shikha shikha, I don't think he's exaggerating. I think it's certainly true that even a gadol b'torah, even Torah giants, even important Torah scholars, their memory for these kinds of things works differently and functions differently than it used to, and therefore you could argue that we've become more used to writing things down or taking notes on them, and that would be a reason he's saying that would allow us to write it down on Chol HaMoed, because it's a davar ha'aved, because it's something you might lose. You might not remember it after Chol HaMoed, and then you won't have it anymore, and so that's a reason to allow it to be written. Besides that, there's this Mishnah Berurah that he refers to that I want us to learn together, so we'll see what he's talking about. The Shulchan Aruch and Aruch Chaim in Hilchos Chol HaMoed writes, if you heard a chiddush, if you heard some new idea, you can write it down so you don't forget it. And so too, if you found a book, and so in the Shulchan Aruch writing this in the 1500s, you saw a sefer, sometimes the sefer was coming through town, somebody owned the sefer, coming through town, and if you didn't have time to read the whole thing because he was leaving, it didn't always just take one day to read a whole sefer, so you'd write it down. Mutar lahatiko, you can copy it. Why can't you, if you're not going to find it later, why not? Because that's the davar havid. It's something that you won't be able to get to after Chol HaMoed so easily, and therefore you're allowed to do that. That's the Shulchan Aruch's psak. The Mishnah Berurah writes, it's not only that if you heard a chiddush and you're worried you'll forget it. You can also go to hear a shir knowing you're going to hear a chiddush Torah, knowing that you're going to want to write it down so you don't forget it. In other words, you're allowed to bring, it's not just it came your way and if you don't write it down, you'll lose it. You're allowed to manufacture a situation where you'll need to write it down because it's chiddushei Torah, because it's important to learn Torah, this is your opportunity to learn Torah. Not only that, says the Mishnah Berurah, there's no distinction between hearing it from somebody else or thinking of it yourself. Let's suppose you're learning Torah or you're involved in Torah and a Torah idea comes to you and it's a novel idea that you hadn't thought of before and you want to write it down, take notes for yourself. You're allowed to do that because it's very common, says the Mishnah Berurah, that a person forgets what an original idea. You know, you have an idea, and then you forget it. I once heard a comedian, I think it was David Steinberg, but I'm not sure, talking about how he would have his best jokes would come to him in the middle of the night in dreams, and he would, like, wake up and then not remember it. In the morning. He'd wake up in the morning, remember he had this great joke, and not remember it. So then he started writing, taking notes by his bed, but he couldn't read in the morning because he would write it very badly. Then he got the idea to record them. So he leaves back in then, it was a tape recorder, which is an old, for those of you who are too young to remember, it was an old machine that used to record things on them. So he has a tape recorder by his bed. He has thinks of the best joke of his life in the middle of the night, wakes up, says, oh, great, tape recorder, records it, and goes back to sleep so excited. Wakes up in the morning, can't remember the joke anymore, but he remembers it was the greatest joke he's ever thought of. Plays the tape back, and he goes, yeah. So, you can forget stuff. People forget stuff. So, this says the Mishnah Berurah, and therefore you're allowed to write it down so you don't forget it. And then he adds, V'afilu b'lo tam shikla. Even if you know you're not going to forget, it's such a great idea, you're never going to forget the idea. Kivan shebechol eid v'rega mutal ha'adam l'mol b'torah. Since we're always obligated to do our best to study Torah and advance in our Torah knowledge, ulechadesh ba kafi yecholto is a very important phrase, and I don't think there's anything debatable about this particular phrase, that each of us at our levels are supposed to be looking not only to absorb Torah, to receive Torah, we're supposed to be taking whatever knowledge comes our way and thinking about it and chewing it over and coming up with at our own levels with the proper humility about what our levels are, but coming up with novel ideas, going from what we have to what the ramifications are, that maybe somebody else has already thought of them, maybe somebody else hasn't, but that's what we're supposed to be doing. So if that's true at every moment, then if I delay, says the Mishnah, now back in the Mishnah, and this is the part that's more novel, that the Mishnah Halachot of Menashe Klein was quoting, if I delay the writing it down, then after Yom Tov, I didn't forget it. So now I'm going to write down the Kiddush. But what's going to happen when I write down the Kiddush now? What does that mean? I'm taking away time from the new Kiddushin that I'm supposed to be doing. Now, theoretically, you could argue that the time you saved on Chol HaMoed was time you could have used for Kiddushin back then, and now you just pushed off this time to that time. But that's not the way the Mishnah Berurah has it. The Mishnah Berurah has it, and it could be because he thinks that reconstructing it after Chol HaMoed will take longer, but he says that at the time that you have the Kiddush, you have a Kiddush on the Chol HaMoed, you have something you want to write down on Chol HaMoed, and it's Torah, you write it down, because if you write it down later, that's going to take away from other Torah study time. So this came along in Chol HaMoed, write it down in Chol HaMoed. So that's in terms of whether there's a halacha not to write things down in Chol HaMoed. So when it comes to Chiddush Torah, he says, I've got a Mishnah Berurah, I've got a rush. I've got an understanding of a rush. Then I have a Shulchan Aruch that says, if I'm forgetting it, forget it. And I've got a Mishnah Berurah that says I can go to Shiurim even though I'm going to then have to write it down. And then even if I'm not going to forget it, I can write it down because that's the time of it and it will take away from other times. So all of that supports his claim that you can write down Torah ideas that you have on Chol HaMoed. And then the man wrote also, and I've never seen any of my Rebbeim. Menashe Klein says, well, I saw a Shuvah in the Chatam Sofer in Ora Chaim, Simon Kuf Pei Dalet, which we're going to get to in a second. But there's also Shuvah in Eben Ezra Pei Vav, and in the Chatam Sofer signs it as Gimel the Chol HaMoed Sukkos. The third day of Chol HaMoed Sukkos, Tav Kuf Samachet of 1827. It's particularly egregious is not the right word, it's particularly striking, it's particularly noticeable, says Rabbi Menashe Klein, in what he calls Kuf Pei Bet, response number 182, but I think I found it in Kuf Pei Dalet. I think in our version it's published as Kuf Pei Dalet is 184. This is in Shu'at Chatam Sofer, Chelek Aleph Or HaChaim, and we're going to look at it together, and the reason why he says it's so, the reason why the Rabbi Menashe Klein says it's so much more, it gives so much better evidence that the Chatam Sofer wasn't terribly worried about writing on Chol HaMoed when it came to Chiddushei Torah, is that this one isn't particularly halacha l'mais. It doesn't seem to have such halachic ramifications, such direct practical halachic ramifications. The story is like it is as follows. A man had an extra etrog. And in Europe, let's remember, etrogim were sometimes very, very rare, but sometimes not so rare. So this man found himself with two etrogim, which means he spent a lot more money than he should have, I think. But he found an extra etrog, so what's he going to do with it? So he hung it in the sukkah as a decoration. And in those times, and this was true in much of European Jewry, there were Jews who lived in smaller villages where they either didn't have a minyan or they just barely had a minyan. And then when it came to Chagim, they sometimes would come to the big town and spend the Chagim in the big town to be able to have a minyan and a nice shul and a nice davening. So one of the people comes from town, from the villages, and gets is there on Yom Tov. They meet up in shul and he sees it and he comes out. He doesn't have an etrog because he didn't find an etrog. Right? You come to shul, there's a guy with an etrog, so you do it. You do on Yom Tov, but. And the man is clearly going back to the village because he's a farmer and he has to do, you know, he has to get back to it's the Zeman HaGitot. So it's, you know, if he's got vines, if he's a wine farmer, if he's a grape farmer, he's got to press the grapes, right? So you can't stay, he can't spend the Chol HaMoed Sukkos in the big town because he's got a big city because he's got to go back and do his farming. And that would mean that on Chol HaMoed, he won't have a chance to shake a lulav because he doesn't have an etrog. He doesn't have the arba minim, the four species. Him and his whole family, right? So the Chasam Sofer says, so I told the other guy that he's allowed to take the etrog that he hung up in the sukkah for a decoration. Now, the challenge or the interesting thing about that is that usually we say that the items that you hang on in the sukkah for decorations become muktzah for the whole holiday. They become tied into, they become dedicated to, set aside for that purpose for the whole holiday. And you can't touch them even, let alone make use of them, over the course of the chag. The Chatham Sofer says, it's true that on Yom Tov it's not allowed because of Muktzah. But on Chol HaMoed, there is no such thing as Muktzah on Chol HaMoed. So you could move them, it's just that you can't get any anah out of them. You can't get any benefit out of them because of it katsai le mitzvato. It's the same root word, but it's slightly different. Muktzah is on a Yom Tov, you can't touch it because it wasn't prepared for any use on the Yom Tov, then you really not allowed to touch it at all. On Chol HaMoed, there's no idea of muktzah, but there is an idea of it katsai le mitzvato. It's muktzah for its mitzvah, as it were, meaning I can move it, but I can't take it away from its mitzvah because it's set aside for its mitzvah. So if I wanted to move a decoration, let's say from the east wall to the west wall of the sukkah, that I could do because it's still part of the same mitzvah. But in terms of hana'a, I can't get any benefit from it. Okay, that's true. Chasam Sofer says, but to turn that now and take it away, use it for a mitzvah, that's clearly allowed. For one reason, we have a principle in halacha called mitzvot lav lehanot nitnu. That mitzvot are not given for the purpose of hana'a. So fulfillment of a mitzvah is not considered a hana'a in halacha. That has a lot of interesting ramifications. So for example, let's suppose, and this ideally shouldn't happen, but let's suppose one Jew says to another Jew, I vow not to get any hana'a from you. I vow not to get any benefit from you. And then it turns out that other Jew that year, let's say you didn't know, it doesn't matter, that Jew is the guy who blows shofar for the whole community. Are you allowed to listen to that guy blow shofar? The answer is yes, because of mitzvah lav lehanot nitnu. Because we don't consider performing a mitzvah a hana'a of the kind, a benefit of the kind that we mean when we say that something is prohibited in benefiting from it. So that would be one reason why you could. So if I take the etrog off the sukkah, on Sukkot, I can't do it. On the Chag itself, on the day of a holiday, the first day of the Yom Tov, the first 2 days of the Yom Tov, we're in Pressburg, I can't take it off because it's Muktzah in the formal sense of I can't touch it. On Chol HaMoed or Motzei Chag, as soon as the Chag is the holiday itself, the days of Isser Melacha is over, so then there's not that, but I can't get Hana'a from it. But using it for mitzvah is an Hana'a. More than that, says the Chatam Sofer. Another reason we're not allowed to move them or to deal with anything with them is because of what's called Bizui Mitzvah. If I use it for some other purpose, it used to be being used for this elevated purpose of mitzvot. Now I take it, I turn it to an etrog jelly, it's a Bizui Mitzvah. Or I just take it off and I just walk around smelling it. It's a Bizui Mitzvah, I'm using it for some other purpose that's not a mitzvah purpose. That's if I'm only using it, if not for a mitzvah purpose, right? Let's say I want to count money near the Nerut Chanukah is the example that he gives, right? That's using the light of the Nerut Chanukah instead of for the elevated purpose of reminding ourselves of the miracle of Chanukah to do something mundane, count money, play poker, play dreidel, whatever it is we're going to do. That's not allowed, which is why we have on Chanukah the Shamash to try to avoid that problem. But to take a mitzvah from one mitzvah and use it for a different mitzvah, said the Chatam Sofer, that's not a Bizui Mitzvah. And therefore, how do I know that? Because we have halacha, let's say you have tzitzis, meaning the actual fringes, the actual strings that hang down, we're allowed to take them off of one beged and put them onto another beged. You might have thought that once they're dedicated to a particular garment, that they have to stick with that garment forever. But let's say the garment wears out. But you don't want to lose the tzitzis, especially today. Those people who wear tchelet tzitzis, I think those are very expensive. They're like $70 a pop, so you don't want to necessarily lose them. If they're in perfectly fine condition, but the tallit is old, so then you can move them. Absolutely allowed. Madlikim min el ner. If you have neros of mitzvah that you want to light, today we use a shemash to light all the neros of mitzvah. The fact is, you should be allowed to light mitzvahs min el ner from one ner to the next candle, because it's not abusing mitzvah to use a mitzvah to do another mitzvah. So therefore here too, not only here, it says the Chatzim Sofer, it's not only that you're moving it to another mitzvah, it's actually a ma'alin ba'kodesh. It's actually taking it to a higher level. Because decorations in a sukkah are what's called noye mitzvah. They're a decoration of mitzvah, which is a value. To make our mitzvahs look nice and be better, that's an important value, but that's not the mitzvah itself. But here now, we're going to make it into an etrog. We're going to use it as an, not make it, it's already an etrog. We're going to use it as an etrog. We're going to make a brach on it. We're going to hold it in our hands as we say hallel. Right? That's a whole thing. So you could say, well, but originally it was a noy, it was a decoration for a mitzvah d'oraita of a sukkah. That's a mitzvah d'oraita all the days of the holiday. But now it's quote, only unquote, a mitzvah d'rabbanan, a rabbinic mitzvah, because after the first day of Sukkot, let's remember the mitzvah to shake the wave to whatever verb you like. Take, wave, shake the Arba Minim, the four species, on the other days of the holiday outside of the Beit HaMikdash. That's a rabbinic addition. By Torah law, you wave a lulav and etrog 7 days in the Beit HaMikdash in the temple, and outside the Beit HaMikdash only 1 day. And then because of the loss of the Beit HaMikdash, Chazal instituted 7 days. And that brings many kulot in terms of our Arba Minim, like if they dry out after the first day, so that is, to a certain extent, that's allowed. And we are still allowed to wave such a, to use such a an item in our Arba Minim, if it's not completely dried out. So there are leniencies about that. So here you might say to yourself, well, I'm taking the etrog off of the sukkah itself, where it was an adjunct to a Torah mitzvah, and now I'm going to use it for a rabbinic mitzvah. Isn't that taking it down a level? But says the Chatzim Sofer, you know, the Maharshal in the Yamshel Shlomo says that noy, the whole idea of decoration, that's a mitzvah d'rabbanan itself. So it turns out that it was performing a rabbinic mitzvah. It's true, that rabbinic mitzvah was an adjunct to a Torah mitzvah, but it was performing a rabbinic mitzvah. Here too, the etrog is a rabbinic mitzvah as well, and therefore it should be the same thing. Another argument you might have had is that etrog needs to be, the etrog that you use in your Arba Minim, in your four species that you're going to wave as part of the lulav etrog hadas and hadasim and aravot combination, needs to be a fruit, because the Torah refers to it as a pre-Eitz Hadar, is the fruit of an Eitz Hadar, of a beautiful tree. And that's a psul on all that. That invalidates an etrog on all days. If it's not, it doesn't qualify as a pre. So if it's something that you're not allowed to eat, is the standard that's used. If it's ein bo heter achila, something you're not allowed to eat. So an example that we'll see in a second is orla. Let's suppose the etrog grew on a tree that wasn't yet 4 years old. Then it's orla, and we're not allowed to get any benefit from whatsoever. So that doesn't count in halacha as a pre. Technically, it's a fruit because I could eat it, but the answer is no. The Torah told me I'm not allowed to eat it, and therefore it's considered not allowed to be eaten, therefore it's considered not a pre. Here too, you should say it's not a pre because you can't eat it. Why can't you eat it? You can't eat it because it was set aside for a mitzvah. It's true, I'm allowed to turn it from one mitzvah to the other mitzvah, but I'm not allowed to eat it, so therefore shouldn't it say that it's not a pre? So the Chatzim Sofer says, no, it's not true. If I found a mitzvah reason to eat it on Yom Tov, such as he has nothing else to eat and there is a mitzvah to be happy on Yom Tov and not to fast, and therefore he's allowed to eat it. So if that's the only thing, then it wouldn't be a bizui mitzvah. It wouldn't be a denigration of the mitzvah because I'd be using it for a valid mitzvah purpose and I could eat it. So therefore he says it qualifies as a pre, and therefore you can use it, and therefore you can move it. So, but then you say to me, but I don't understand. If the standard is, if I have nothing else to eat, then what about orla? Or about what about truma tumea? So truma tumea is truma, the piece of the beginning of the harvest that you give to the Kohen, which is supposed to be eaten betahara in complete ritual purity. If it gets tummy, you have to burn it. But it says the Chatzim Sofer, but even those two, which you're not really allowed to get benefit from, you're not allowed to eat, you're not allowed to enjoy, if you had somebody who's ill, deathly ill, we push the whole Torah aside for people who are deathly ill, so certainly we would allow them to eat this stuff. So Chatzim Sofer says, no, that's not considered a heter achila. That's not considered that you're allowed to eat it. That's considered it's medicine. You're allowed to eat, not allowed. When somebody's deathly ill, they sometimes ingest things that are poisonous, right? Cancer patients take chemotherapy, which is poisonous. So the fact that somebody takes something or ingests something, some people take very bitter things that aren't ordinarily thought of as food, let's say cod liver oil. not thought of as food in general. It's only taken as a medicine. That doesn't count as a food. So too, if we were to say that a Jew, that a person who's deathly ill, a Jew who's deathly ill, is allowed to eat truma, temea, or orla, when they're ordinarily not allowed to because they're deathly ill, that doesn't mean that those things count as payrot, as fruit, as food. It means they count in those situations as medicine that can be used, whatever it is. But in our situation, so it's a mitzvah, and it's a mitzvah of eating on Yom Tov, and it's a mitzvah, and therefore the etrog counts as a pri, and therefore that's what it is. Chazal actually allows the guy to take, and then take money for it, because he says then you're not, it's not that you're benefiting from Isur. No, it's really, anyway. The different discussion, but that is the Chatam Sofer's basic idea that you're allowed to use this etrog and give it or sell it to this Jew from the village so that he can have an etrog. And then he says at the end, I can't go on for very long. I've only written down these things so I don't forget them. It's Chol HaMoed Sukkah. So when he says I've written down and forget them, it means that he told them the psak already. They got the benefit from the psak. So why is he writing it down now? He's not writing it down for a... It's not like he's writing it to faraway people who need his written answer. He's given the answer. He's writing it down. He says he's writing it down to remember it on Chol HaMoed Sukkah. And not in Pressburg. I'm sorry. He was in Resnitz at the time in 1828. And he signs it. Why is that important to us? It's important to us, first of all, it shows the Chassid Sofer did it. But then Rav Menashe Klein says, Im kein anu, he means me, mi talmidei talmidav. I'm from the students of the students of Chassid Sofer, meaning if I told you I found a Chassid Sofer, did this, and therefore I'm going to follow it, that's fine, because I'd say Chassid Sofer is a great Torah scholar. But this man who had written to Rav Menashe Klein said, we haven't seen any of our rebbeim. We have no tradition from our strand of the world of Torah. He says, I'm from the strand of the Chatam Sofer. It would be like if I were to say, you know, Chaim Soloveitchik, the who founded, or people say, found the Brisker method, the Rav, Rabbi Yosef Soloveitchik, or his great-grandfather, Rabbi Yosef Beit Halevi. If I were to say, you know, they did something, and they're the Rebbeim of the Rebbeim of my Rebbeim, that would be what the Rav Menashe Klein is saying right here. I find you a Chassam Sofer, and a Chassam Sofer is in fact a Rebbe of a Rebbe of my Rebbe. I am from that strand, and therefore it shows that in my strand of the Torah world, in my accepted authorities of the Torah world, we sometimes write on Chol HaMoed Sukkot, on Chol HaMoed V'Chag, because we don't want to forget, and that is what allows us to write on Chol HaMoed our Chiddushei Torah. So that is responsible day. I gave it to you on the 19th of Tishrei. It's really responsible day just about Chol HaMoed, writing Chol HaMoed Chiddushei Torah, and that is responsible day for this day. Chag Kasher V'Sameach, you don't say Kasher V'Sukkah, just a Chag Sameach, and enjoy the rest of the holiday.